Welcome to a very special episode of Pop Culture Failure. Welcome to a very special episode of Pop Culture Failure. I am Sky.
I'm Jake.
And today we are not reviewing one of the episodes of Ninja Turtles: The Next Mutation. Instead, we interviewed somebody who worked on that show.
What?
We interviewed Rick Orner. He was on-set mechanic, keeping the animatronic heads working. And he also was the temporary voice for the Dragon Lord and the Dragon Lord's primary puppeteer.
He literally answers all the questions you could have about this show. Maybe not all of them, but a lot of them.
A lot of points that we make, he covers.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And I have a better appreciation for this show.
And I feel a little bad for bad-mouthing the lip-syncing of the robot. But it's not his fault.
No, it's not. It's
you'll find out why. Don't they'll just stop now, Sky.
I suppose that's true.
They'll be like, oh, okay, and then it'll be off.
We also didn't mention to him the overall tone of the show. So, Rick, if you feel betrayed, I am indeed sorry.
It's entirely Sky's fault.
No, I asked Jake if we should tell you, and he said no.
That's not it.
Yeah, I have documented evidence of that. I take screenshots, bitch.
Anyway.
I don't know how to segue into
anyway, that. Enjoy this interview with Rick Orner. You never listened to a fucking podcast before?
And joining us today for this very special episode is Rick Orner.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, we're doing great. And thank you very, very much for joining us. It's really awesome to have you here.
Thanks.
Yeah. So, why don't you tell us what you did for Ninja Turtles: The Next Mutation?
Yeah, tell us who you are. Like, we tracked right. you down on the internet, and now this is your moment.
Yeah, this is all because I happened to comment on a webpage that, like, hey, on set, I was the Dragon Lord.
Yeah.
And
which is awesome.
Yeah. Well, it was fun to do. You know, of course, it's not my voice in it, and I wasn't in the suit because I'm a tall, skinny guy. They had a big muscly guy wearing that.
You don't have a dragon's build?
No. But basically, at the time, I've been a freelance special effects artist pretty much since 90, I think is when I got into that field. My first movie was the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids sequel.
Oh, really?
Built a giant stuffed animal with a shop. You know, I was a low man on the totem pole in that job.
That's and still then cooler than anything we've ever done.
That's true. So and then, it was a giant bunny, right? Like a giant pink bunny?
Yeah, it was like a stuffed animal that, you know, because the little kid gets turned into a giant. Yeah. And the stuffed animal is, and they're hanging it from a helicopter to lure the baby.
The street, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And a good movie.
And of course, classically, I did the full size body was my project that I worked on with, you know, with a handful of people. And I didn't see it in the theater because I was busy when that movie was out. And so then I waited until it was on VHS at the time, you know, and I got the tape. And of course, it wasn't widescreen. So I watched the whole movie, got to the end credits, and I could see, like, oh, yeah, just off the side of the screen is what I did. So, classic. You know,
if it helps, I think I might have seen that in the theater.
Oh, nice. I'm glad somebody appreciated it. But, yeah, that kind of stuff always happens. It's always like one of the movies I worked on with this awesome shop guy, Rick Lazzarini, who was the guy who designed the Alien the Queen Alien's mechanisms for Stan Winston. He has his own shop, the character shop. And I was working for him on Mimic, and it was a real thrill that they did one shot. I did the abdomen on the Mimic creature, the outer shell. That was my little private project. And there is a shot when it pans down and it's full screen wiggling around. And it's like so rare when you know, you work on these things for like 3 months. And sometimes it's like, yeah, man, you can't really see anything I did, but you know, but you just have to be happy you got the paycheck and
yeah,
you kept your boss happy. So you get hired again, get to work on another project. But so anyway, the Ninja Turtles, I went in, I was working for Kyoto Brothers. You know, this is all freelance stuff, but Kyoto Brothers are like awesome guys, nicest guys in the business. It's three Italian brothers. I believe they're from New Jersey. I could be getting that wrong, but they did like Large Marge and Pee Wee's Big Adventure. They do stop motion and puppets, and they did Team America World Police. They did all those puppets. Cool. They're the nicest guys in the world. And you know, anybody who's worked with them knows that, like, yeah, they're like the real deal. They're not a bunch of jerks. You know, they're super great guys. And I was working with them. I think it's the only movie that I worked on that I never saw was the we did props for the Carrot Top movie, Chairman of the Board.
I don't think I saw that one.
I was unaware that Carrot Top had a movie.
Yeah, I worked on it, and it's the one movie I'm like, yeah, nah, it's okay. I don't need to
see it. I did see Carrot Top live once, and it was really surprisingly funny.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought, you know, it would have been hard because, you know, if a guy's doing prop comedy, but you built the prop, so like you're not really going to appreciate the guy, you know?
Yeah,
it's like,
I guess
wait,
that's true.
I'm getting these laughs, not him, you know? Right. But yeah, I did a head polisher or something for bald guys. but anyway, and then the Chiodo brothers said, you know, hey, we're going to be doing this Ninja Turtle thing. You want to stay on and work on that? And, the head mechanic in the build was this guy, Wes Kafer, who I learned a lot of great stuff from. He was really experienced in doing animatronic heads. And we had some other guys there, and it was just a great crew. And we built, what did we have to do? Three heads for each of the five turtles, because there was a girl turtle, of course. So yeah, because there you'd need an A and a B head so that you could have one working and be fixing one. And then you'd need a third one just in case, because you can't, you know, the first rule in film production is if you're making the entire crew stand around and wait for you, you're blowing it, you know, because it's thousands of dollars flying out the window. So, you know, we had a lot to build, so we had to kind of figure out a way to automate it. And we made skulls that had the teeth incorporated and all the mounting points. We made molds for that, and we cast them out of fiberglass. And we built these things, and I think there were 16 servos per head. So there was a lot going on just to be packed around someone's head and the 1 inch around their head.
How heavy were the heads?
They're not overly heavy, probably, you know, 5 pounds or something. They
That's terrible.
But they were really loud when they were inside. Like when I put one on, it reminded me of like if you were in a pet shop that sold a lot of parrots and they were all squawking at the same time. It was like that level of just obnoxious. But the way it worked is the actors had earbuds in that went to a little wireless thing that the sound guy could send them the audio from the puppeteers.
Okay.
And so the puppeteers had all these cases that we had built, and you'd open up the cases and there was two joysticks and a laptop, and it used a like wireless modem to communicate. It was pretty high tech. I didn't design the electronics and stuff, but, and so they would sit there and they could puppeteer the faces while they would read the lines out loud. And then the actors wearing the suits would hear the dialogue, and then they could do the body motions in response to that. But they were almost blind in there, because basically if you look carefully, look at the bottom edge of the mask, you'll see there's little tiny slits right on the bottom edge of the mask.
Yeah.
Just under the eye mask. Yeah.
And we have now, noticed in the background, occasionally they will bump into things.
Oh yeah. You should see the outtakes. There was in one episode, like somebody was like, I think somebody was like tossing Mikey a softball or something in the middle of the shot. You know, it's just like, hey, Mikey, here, like that. And he throws the softball over. And that took so many takes, because there's two guys who can't see at all wearing gloves with only two fingers trying to grab a ball that it was just total random chance that he.
It sounds fantastic, though.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot. Yeah, there's some good. Also, sometimes when like the electronics would glitch out and like the eyes would just start rolling random places and the lips would move around, there were some pretty ridiculous looking moments. So anyway, getting back to the beginning of the story, so I went and did the thing for the Chiodo brothers, and then they nicely asked me if I wanted to go up with the crew. to maintain the suits on set. There was basically only three of us who could go up because shooting in Canada, you can't bring a lot of American crew with you. You know, you're supposed to hire locally. So actually, when we got to Canada, Canadian authorities pulled each of the three of us aside and we were separately interrogated as to why a Canadian couldn't do the same job. You know, and for me, it was pretty easy. I was just like, well, I built this thing and nobody in Canada knows how it works. So that's why. Full Canadian crew of dressers and technicians when we get there. So it's good for Canada. And they were like, all right, good to go. And it, you know, so basically the show was Saban did it after the success of Power Rangers. And then they thought, well, why don't we, you know, resurrect the Ninja Turtle franchise and make a Ninja Turtle one? You know, unfortunately, I don't think they realize that there's going to be a lot more to it when you make the faces move, unlike the Power Rangers, where you can just shoot stuff and dub anything in later.
Yeah, so helmets are very different from animated faces.
Yeah. You know, it's a little more to do. But I mean, one thing I've noticed is, like, if you read on the webpage or the Wikipedia article, it talks about how it didn't do that well. And actually the show, I think, was the number one show on Fox Kids that year. Like, it actually got viewers, but what it didn't do was sell toys because the toys were crappily made. And
the toys don't match the turtles in the show, really.
Like, yeah.
Sort of a different style.
They're horrible. And you know, and that was right at the time when, like, the McFarlane toys had just kind of taken off and that quality was out there now. And just so in comparison, the toys were really lame. And so the fact that the toys didn't sell is the real reason why the show was canceled. There's an inside scoop.
It's an exclusive here, folks.
Yeah. It was, I think it did fairly well. You know, I think it was a pain in the butt for them to shoot. And so basically it was Saban using a cheaper subsidiary in Canada, which is Shavik Studios, I believe, if I remember the name correctly, which was basically some old, like, in welding warehouses where they used to make parts for bridges that had been converted into a movie studio, in quotes. I'm doing air quotes, you can't see. And it was basically an alley with a couple of warehouses off it and some, you know, dressing room trucks parked in it and a generator sitting out in the alley. And, you know, and one had a permanent set, which was the sewer, which was built up, I don't know, 5 feet off the ground because they had to have the drop part for the train car to sit in, Splinter's car. So that whole thing was built up. So that was a cool set to hang out on. We shot two episodes every seven shooting days. Jeez, so,
wow. That is
so rigorous. Yeah. So it was, we had to work fast. And basically every episode, if you look at it, it's pretty much half the episode is fighting and half the episode is dialogue. Mm-hmm. So we had two units running at any time. And so I stayed with the main unit that did all the faces because that's where all the animatronic heads, the stunt team had, Paula, a friend of mine, she was in charge of that. And she had this stunt team there and they had these foam heads basically they had kind of posable lips and eyelids that just had, you know, armature wire in them. So you could pose them into exciting faces. Unfortunately, I've noticed that, like, the DVD release has those heads on it and they're posed horribly. So it just looks awful. And the stunt guys also never liked that they had to see through tiny little slits. So they were always pulling them open wider. So especially during the stunts, if you look, you'll notice that the eyes are like the little slit at the bottom of the mask. They're like sometimes are pulled way open. And it just looks awful. But basically, so those guys would be out doing those fighting scenes. And there was the stunt coordinator, and he ended up directing all the fighting sequences. He was like a second unit director. And then we'd have a new director for every 7 days of shooting, and we'd knock out two episodes. So basically we had the equivalent of one episode per unit to shoot. And let's see, we did, so there was a lot to do, and we just had to make sure that it all worked well. And the other thing is our crew had to be there an hour before and we could leave an hour after because we had to get all our stuff out and set up and working. And then we had to put it away. Right. So we were doing 12-hour days most days. So we were doing 14 hours. And then, you know, the whole deal with the turtles only going out at night meant that all exterior shoots were night shoots. So we tended to start the week doing night shoots, and then they would try to push it as fast as possible back to be daytime by the end of the 7 days. So like the way it worked out is like the camera crew union, they got at least 8 hours off, but subtract 2 hours from that for us. So we'd be on for like 14, off for six, on for 14, off for six, on for 14, off for six. We just go the whole week, and then I would sleep Saturday and then poke around Vancouver Sunday and then go back and have fun. But you know, the nice thing was I worked for the Chiodo brothers and not for that production company.
Okay.
So, you know, my responsibility was to the Chiodo brothers, make sure their suits look good, make sure they're working, make sure that there's no downtime, make sure that everything's working smoothly. So when things were working well, I could kind of relax. And about halfway through the shoot, we got sick of hearing the set chatter on the walkie talkies. Cause you know, just usually on a movie set, your walkie talkies just constantly like, okay, lock it up, rolling, da da da, you know, just constantly blasting out of your walkie talkie. And we were like, how about if we get a special turtle channel so we can communicate to each other? And then if anything goes wrong, you just switch over to this channel and ask for us. And it was great. Cause then we could just the radio would just be silent and I could just relax and, you know, do some other little chores around there, get things ready. And then all of a sudden I'd hear like, Mikey's not working. I just run in. Oh yeah. This wire needs to be reconnected. Here you go. Nice.
I think that it's super rad that you had a turtle com specifically.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, and one thing that's cool, if I can find it, I'll take a picture of it and send it to you guys. But my name tag on the set, they asked like what title, what my position is, and they just let me make it up. So I actually had a name tag that said Turtle Mechanic on it. So
fantastic.
I was like yep, Turtle Mechanic. It was intense and fun. The guys who wore the suits, Leonardo was Gabe, Donatello was Richard, Raphael was Mitch, and Michelangelo was Jared, and Nicole was Venus. And it was a really hard job because we didn't have a nice refrigerated room to be in. It was hot for people in shorts and a t-shirt, and these guys are wearing foam rubber things with giant mechanical heads on, and you know, it's claustrophobic and hot, and Gabe in particular tended to sweat a lot, and we'd pull his suit off, and Gabe's the greatest guy in the world, so I'm not putting him down at all, but we'd pull his suit off and it would be pounds heavier. Oh. You know, just like, you know, but you know, you gotta, when you're working together and those kind of things, you get everyone's
sacrifice for your art.
Everyone's in close to each other, and we all get used to each other's smells and everything. Yeah, it's just what you're gonna do. Yeah. And so, you know, and the other thing is foam latex suits, you can't throw them in a washing machine or something. They can't really be washed properly. They're sponges basically, right? Yeah. So what you do with foam latex is you blast it with something to kill all the bacteria, because that's what's really going to make it turn nasty. So you like Lysol spray, you just kill everything on it. And then you hang it in a room that we had built that has space heaters in it and then a lot of airflow.
Okay.
And they just dry out. And we had multiple suits for each character. And they would just, so you basically disinfect them and then dry them.
Right.
So by the end of, you know, it was 5.5 months we were up there. So by the end of that 5.5 months, it was, you know, those suits had to have had like, you know, pounds of salts and minerals and stuff that was in sweat, you know, and just collected in them. Yeah, nasty.
Gross.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not. These aren't as glamorous as they as they're made out to be. But so, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
You were saying that this wasn't properly like air conditioned or whatever. So how often would you have an actor pass out while wearing the suit?
Only one time did it get that far. We were doing, you know, the rave episode.
Yes,
where
yes.
they have a rave party. who was it? It was Donatello. Okay. When in the middle of that crowd, because it was really hot that day, because there were so many bodies in there. I mean, I was dripping and I was wearing a shorts and a t-shirt, and there was like in the middle of one thing where they're dancing in the middle of the crowd, and he just went boom, he just dropped down. It was like, uh oh,
he was hitting on those girls too hard. That
yeah.
That's what he does all of that episode.
Yeah, he was the player, man. I kind of like Donnie because I was like the mechanical guy on set. So I was like, he's me.
That's, you do machines.
Yeah. although in real life, Mikey and I got into the most trouble, like poking around, because Jared was a madman. Here's a little inside trivia. Jared, who wore the Mikey suit, was in Stephen King's It, the original one.
Oh, really?
And you know, there's like the bully. I don't know if you guys know that movie, but there's the group of bullies that are mm-hmm. harassing the main kid. He's the leader of the group of bullies, and then he when he sees it in person, his hair turns white, and you see him as an old man later in the mental hospital. But that was Jared was the main bully, and the mm-hmm. guy who was kind of in that group of bullies, who's kind of like the smaller guy in the group, who's kind of like, you're not going to let him talk to you that way, huh? Like that, the guy who was that character, that was Gabe, who played Leonardo. So
nice.
Next time you watch It, you can see there's a couple of Ninja Turtles in there. You know, like basically I knew going into a project like that if my job, part of my job is making sure that these guys are as comfortable as possible and they can do their work and not, constantly be hindered by the suit. So I was, and I wanted to make it as comfortable. And I told them that right at the beginning. It's like, if something's rubbing somewhere, we'll put a little bit of moleskin in it and we'll get it, you know, we'll work on this for you. Cause I knew that we're the first people they're going to complain about if they're having a bad day. Cause they're going to say, the people are putting us in these horrible suits. So, you know, I ended up being kind of good friends. I went to Jared's wedding and all kinds of stuff. So you know, it's a happy ending. But we had we went through a weird and interesting, you know, brutal production schedule. And
how many weeks did you guys shoot then?
It was 13? 5.5 months.
5.5 months.
We were up there.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was most of the summer. You know, there were rainy days, being Vancouver, so some of those days, like, if you look in the background, there will be rain, but there's a tent over the top of where we're actually shooting. So, you know, but if you really look, it's like, oh yeah, it is raining way back there. Cause you know, whenever it's outdoors, it's pretty much Stanley Park. And, there's, one of the most fun ones is there's that one time when they go to the aquarium and there's like the big, the huge wall of tanks that are like, there's like an orca inside. And that was fascinating because we were shooting at night. And the entire time we were shooting that orca was just sitting right at the window, just watching. Cause it was like, he was just like, whoa, you know, like, yeah, you could tell it was like, this is something interesting to watch. Like, this is different. It was totally aware and watching, like probably trying to figure out like, what the hell are those four green guys doing running around? You know, couldn't figure it out.
So but the whales are Ninja Turtle fans also.
That's true. And the reason why you guys found me is because I just made a comment on one of the Turtlepedia, I guess it is.
Yeah, and I was just Googling things about this show one day because I was bored.
Yeah, and so in addition to the turtle suits, the Kyoto Brothers provided some of the makeup stuff, like the, the Queez mask that went around his face. And they all had to be built to be kind of easy to take on and off because we didn't have time to be doing application of appliances and gluing things on and doing that level of makeup effects. They also did Wick, the puppet, that, you know, two of our puppeteers who did Mikey and Raphael, I believe. I'm trying to remember who did what, but they also puppeteered Wick and Bill and Adam, great guys. They had an effects shop up there of their own, and we got them as puppeteers, and they did a lot of the great X-Files monsters and stuff like that.
The degrees of like how things hook to the show are
More interesting. Kevin Bacon even, all over this place.
Yeah, there's all kinds of. And then do you guys know that inside a Splinter suit was an attractive girl?
Is that right? We figured it was a girl because he's got a blonde girl body,
yeah.
But
yeah, sometimes she walked a little dainty the way she walked around. Yeah, but it was Fiona, and she was super nice, and that was fun. But so we had these animatronic heads for the main characters, but the budget really didn't. The Chiodo brothers couldn't talk them into coming up with more budget to do villains
thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, they were used to every character on the Power, like nobody's mouth ever moves on the Power Rangers, right?
Right.
All monsters just stand there. And so they didn't want to pay for a Dragon Lord to have a moving mouth at all. And so we got up there, and one day we were just sitting around and just going like, you know what? Like, we called back to Chiodo Brothers, like, you mind? I know they didn't want to pay for it, but we could probably just spend like an hour and just cut the jaw off and put in a hinge and throw one servo in there and use the standard radio control rig and just make his mouth move, you know, just simple. I know they didn't pay for it, but we're already here and it's not going to, you know, we have the stuff laying around. We could do that. And it'll look so much better than just him not moving his mouth ever.
That does answer one of my big questions, is because like the turtles' mouths have so much intricacy to them.
Yeah.
Their lips like, snarl up and everything, but the Dragon Lord looks really cool, but his mouth doesn't move quite like the turtles does, so that makes sense.
So the turtles, like, if you want to know all the servos and the turtles, let's see if I can remember all 16. One on each side for the main jaw motion, they were paired together. It's basically two for each eye, because there's left, right, up, down motion for the eyes, blink mechanism for the eyelids, one for each eyebrow motion, and then six of them around the mouth to move the lips, right? So we could, you know, you could kind of pinch to, you know, open up the middle and make a Q kind of sound, or you can make a big wide thing, you can make them smile. Oh, there was also corner of the mouth bend upward and downward, and they were pretty well automated. There was one time when a character had to blink and we had to kind of go into our program and set it up so we could move just one eye independent of the other, you know, because that was part of the deal.
But didn't ask for this.
That was, you know, it was fun to that was the fun stuff. It's like improvising, like, oh, how are we going to do that with this character? So we got the Dragon Lord, and we were like, we can do this thing, but now, you know, now if we're going to be moving the mouth, now somebody needs to puppeteer it when we're on the set. And if you're going to be puppeteering, you're going to have to kind of read the lines out loud on the set, which is what the puppeteers did for all the Ninja Turtles.
True.
So you would read the line and you could do the lip sync to that. Unfortunately, the guys who did the voices don't seem like they were really directed to like watch the rhythms that the puppeteers originally did. So the lip sync was actually much better on set. It's like, you know, there was really good lip sync by the last episodes when those guys really got it down. There were some really good performers and puppeteers.
So cool to see.
You know,
watch them actually puppeteer it.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, they really get like the mouth shapes perfect and it looked really good. But then the guys who did the final voices, which I don't know if you guys ever watch Monk? Because on Monk, the guy who was the second in command of the police that they were dealing with, the kind of buffoon sidekick to the cop, that was the guy who did the voice of Donatello. So that was kind of interesting.
Nice.
Another connection. I think it's all, you know what it is. It's these, all these people are, Vancouver film industry people. So that's and so much as
did go on to do Splinter in one of the Michael Bay movies. So
yeah, you know, and it's like, I'm sure, you know, like I know that people that were PAs that are, you know, still Facebook friends of mine that were dressing PAs and stuff, they've done art department on some of the CW, like Arrow and The Flash and stuff. I saw in one of those shows there was a graveyard scene and they went past a gravestone. And I saw a name of somebody that I worked with. I'm like, ah, somebody slipped their name in. Yeah, that's awesome. But so, you know, I was like, oh, I'll puppeteer the Dragon Lord. I'm here. I'm going to be here every single day standing around and I'm a ham. I'll do that. So, my Dragon Lord was a little different than he ended up being on the thing. But when I was doing it, it was always kind of like, bring me the turtles. You know, I was like, that kind of, you know, I want their shells now. And, you know, it was just fun. I mean, it really is kind of a great kind of geek fantasy to be able to stand in a, you know, a Ninja Turtle setting with all these guys standing around and there's a big guy on stage and you're moving his mouth and you're making him talk. And it's just like, yeah, awesome. You know,
also Dragon Lord has all like most of my favorite lines. He says weenie a lot and sweetie pie. It makes me laugh.
Yeah. It was, you know, I mean, I think part of what was good about that show is that they had fun with it and they didn't take it too seriously. And
that's true.
You know who is always great? Like, we always loved when there was a Bone Steel episode because the guy who played Bone Steel, what was his name? I have it right in front of me so I could pull it up.
We looked him up.
Steve Bloom?
No, it's the other Wolverine.
It's the other Wolverine.
Neil something.
Yeah, anyway. But he was Scott McNeil.
That's it. Yep.
I can cut it so it sounds like we remember it right away.
Yeah. Perfect. But yeah, Scott McNeil was like, you know, he's a local comedy guy. He's done, if you look him up, you'll see that he's done like a bajillion voices for cartoons.
We recognized him as Wolverine from Wolverine and the X-Men.
X-Men Evolution.
Or X-Men Evolution.
And, you know, and he just had a comedy background. So whenever he was on set, he was just always being funny and just always like, you saw how he played that character, just ridiculous. And, you know,
he was very much cartoon.
Yeah, like David Lee Roth would have been more subtle in his, with his, but you know, that was what was great. He just, you know, he just turned it all into that, and it was just we were always laughing at the end of the takes, and you know, and you know, that's really what you need when you're doing a show like that, because it could be just brutal just doing those hours, but you know, then you just like, you know what, we're putting people in Ninja Turtle suits and we're having them run around and do dumb things, and you know, and I didn't get to do a lot of stunt crew stuff, but the stuff I did get to see was amazing, like watching guys get yanked through breakaway walls but with a cable attached to their back and, you know, launched off of pneumatic platforms into piles of boxes, and those guys were amazing. Like
that does like sound pretty awesome.
Some of the stunt guys, like, imagine, I can't imagine doing it in, you know, with nothing on, but like these guys in those suits with those big shells hanging off their back and almost blind could like do a flip and land on their feet again without even running up. They could just be standing still and then just go boom, flip over and land on their feet again. And just awesome. Like, because they I mean, most of the stunt guys, they had to be small, like all the actors and all the stunt guys had to be fairly small because they're not big characters. So you know, they were all in the 5 foot range, I think. And so like most of the stunt guys came from like martial arts and gymnastics backgrounds. So like one of the guys was like kickboxing champion of the world at one point.
Really?
You know, so these guys could just, you know, do these crazy, like fly through the air and flip, and it was just awesome to watch them. Like there's stuntmen who are like can do falls and stuntmen who can drive cars, and they're just totally different skill sets. But like guys who do martial arts, you know, and that kind of stuff, it's just amazing to watch them because it's the gymnastics and that was fun.
It sounds like they're literal actual ninjas if they can go from a stand to a backflip mm-hmm. or whatever. That's mm-hmm.
that sounds cooler than the show ever would even allow. Like,
yeah,
they won't let children watch people beat the crap out of each other.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's funny. I mean, what was the thing with it was like in England they couldn't show nunchucks or
yeah,
something.
They had to change, they couldn't even say ninja, they had to change it to Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
Oh, that's right,
nunchucks. That's yeah. also might be why Michelangelo has tonfa in Temptation.
Yeah,
what else? Yeah, in the original cartoon, like, he stops using the nunchucks and just has that grappling hook that they all had.
Yeah,
what did his grabber.
Yeah, and now, like, I'm a bit older, so like, I you know, I'm more from the generation of like Star Wars and, you know, Alien, all that, and Blade Runner and all that kind of stuff. And so, like, the Ninja Turtles kind of came along when I was kind of originally, like, when I was kind of early college. And so I didn't grow up watching Ninja Turtles as a child. And so when I got this job, I kind of had a crash course in Ninja Turtle lore, and just to kind of catch, like, I had never really learned all the inside scoop on, you know, what all the different characters are. So it's kind of a fun crash course in that. And now I, you know, but now
we yeah. have to go back, because you said the secret uh-huh. word, because I could give a crap about Ninja Turtles. You said Star Wars. Is that one of the, like, you know, every special effects person is like, oh, I yeah. saw Star Wars and that did it. Is that your story?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I was 11 when Star Wars came out. So okay. I was kind of, and like, it's hard to imagine that, you know, pre-Star Wars, there was nothing like Star Wars at right. all, you know? So, like, I remember just, you know, my first experience of seeing it in the theater and just being like, what is this? And, you know, like, and then, of course, after that, for the next couple of years, there was a lot of, for the first time, like, behind the scenes of, like, how movies are made
yeah,
and special
yeah, they
effects.
Released a lot of that stuff with that.
And, you know, and I was already doing some, like, Super 8 film, not 8mm video, but it's like literally Super 8 film, stop motion. And I was already kind of making home movies. So Star Wars really made me like, oh my God, this is awesome. And I mean, and I ended up going to film school. And then, I mean, I haven't exclusively done special effects, but when I got out, I had done a lot of art department stuff. So I got jobs building the props, and then that led to, you know, one of the shops I worked at, the guy saying, hey, you know how to machine? Here, let me show you. And I just picked awesome. Up a lot of skills over the years. And I've been doing that. And I mean, lately I've been doing actually a lot more computer graphics, more for graphic design purposes. But, you know, yeah, I use it all. It's just all in different areas. So
yeah, but it's all really cool.
Yeah.
Thanks. I mean, for me, it's I like figuring out how to do something that you don't know, you don't have the solution when you go in. It's not like I imagine if I installed countertops, you know, I would know how to install a countertop, and it would just be, there'd be some little challenges to the job. But what I like about special effects is you just kind of go, I have no idea how I'm going to do this. Yeah. And then you just have to figure it out, you know.
Awesome.
Was there ever a point in the shooting or whatever where they asked you to build something and you didn't know how to do it, or like, did you have to ever make anything whole cloth?
We didn't have to do a lot of building of stuff on set, because we didn't really we weren't providing the props or any of the special like stuff for particular episodes. We had a set of costumes that we were representing for the Kyoto Brothers, and so basically, you know, sometimes we'd have to adapt to the situation, like I was telling you with the making one eye blank when we didn't have our program designed to do that. But they had some great art department people up there who were building the, you know, like when they did the robot versions, they built that extra stuff to put on and, you know.
Right.
Were you guys responsible for the ape in the episode where Raph and Bone Steel get caught in that haunted house?
No, that was... that was a lot of times with these animal costumes, the costume will be owned by a performer who's really good at playing that particular animal.
Really?
And you'll rent them out as a unit and they'll come to the set. Yeah, I have a friend who does bear suits and has appeared on everything from Saturday Night Live to, you know, whatever, all different shows and commercials. Yeah. And so this guy was a guy that they brought in. He had a really good gorilla suit and he took care of it. And, you know, and he was the only one to handle it. We didn't have to handle his suit. And the actually kind of a funny story that was what I like to think of as the best day of work I ever had was on that episode. Cause there was the haunted house and it was just Raphael in that one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
And Leo and Donnie like hanging out around a couch a little bit.
Yeah. But mostly the main shoot was in the haunted house with the gorilla and Raphael. And so it was a really easy episode for our crew because we only had one turtle the whole time, you know? So,
yeah.
And, I remember coming to set and I was always tired because, you know, when you have only 6 hours off between shoot, you know, between 14 hour days, by the time you get home, you're going to maybe get 4 hours if you could get right to sleep, you know, cause you have travel time and eating and mostly I'd eat on the set and stuff. But anyway, I got there this one morning, I was tired. And then I looked at the call sheet and Raphael's call time was like 3 or 4 hours into the day. So like there was nothing for me to do for like 3 or 4 hours. And I was like, oh man, like I could have just come in later. This is like the one day I could have slept in. And so I was kind of bummed out, but I was friends with Mitch who played Raphael. And I was like, Mitch won't mind if I go in his dressing room, you know, it's in the truck. Like, and I just kind of crash out on his thing. And then when he shows up, I'll be like, cool. You know, like he's here now. I'll get him dressed. I'll get him ready and we'll get the thing shot. So I like laid down on this thing and I was so tired. I just totally passed out. And then I like woke up and I was like surprised that Mitch hadn't shown up and like woken me. And I felt really weirdly rested. And I like went out and like Mitch had seen me sleeping and been like, I won't bother him. And he just got himself dressed and like, well, and our suits were really well made and they were great. But like I slept for like, I don't know, like 8 hours or something. Oh, and got paid handsomely for it. So, but I mean, the thing is that the suits that we built, and I would say I'm not the main person responsible for the reliability of it. Wes Kafer, the main mechanic, had a lot more experience than me. His knowledge, kind of making the mechanical part of it work well, was, you know, he was excellent. And then Tom Costin is the guy who designed the electronics, and he came up with us. He was kind of our main guy representing the Kyoto Brothers, and he designed great electronics for it. And with imagine, okay, so there's 16 servos times 5 turtles times 3 heads. Yikes. So that's a lot of possible failure. And
my goodness, yeah.
And I think we only replaced like 4 or 5 servos the entire time.
Oh, really? That's a
That was the only amount, like, because part of it was that Tom Costin designed these like really great control systems where if there was a loss of power, the servos would, this is kind of getting technical, but they wouldn't drive all the way to the end of their motion, which is what usually kills the servo, is like it'll try to keep going, it won't stop, and it'll push up against something where it can't move and just strip out its gears on the inside. Mm-hmm. And he designed it so if there was a loss of power, they would just stop in place and you could set limits, and they were just elegantly designed. But I mean, I think our crew, there were days when the generator caught on fire and we had to wait half a day for the rental company to come and replace the generator. Mm-hmm. And it was downtime. So I think our crew cost the production the least amount of downtime of any of the crews, which considering the fact we're the only crew that built our own equipment from scratch, like I feel pretty proud of that achievement. 'Cause, you know, there's lots of stuff that would go wrong, and it was a fun time. And we the other thing was the communication system. The Tom Costin, he had built this thing with he used, what were they, like microwave wireless modems that were, I guess, were designed for industrial robots to talk to each other, like in a warehouse or something.
Okay.
So, like, really awesome technology. And I think Tom was a guy who went to school to get like an aerospace engineering degree, and he worked in that field for a little bit, and then he didn't like the corporate structure, so then he just started building radio control helicopter cameras and all kinds of, he's just a genius, crazy genius guy. And so he
sounds like he had Donatello.
Yeah, he was the real Donatello. Yeah, I guess realistically I'm more of a Mikey.
You know, aren't we all more of the,
yeah.
No, I'm kind of a buzzkill, so I'm more like Leonardo.
Oh yeah,
yeah, like, yeah. I think the one you don't want to be is Raphael. So
yeah, that's true.
He's cool. He's the one you like to look at, but you wouldn't actually want to have to be him. But these wireless modems, they were amazing because, like, he was smart because he's like, we're going to be on a set. There's going to be radio. There's going to be, you know, walkie talkies going. There's going to be radio controlled focus for the camera. The sound guys are going to be sending stuff through radio waves. Like, we want to stay out of that spectrum entirely. And so that's why he did this whole microwave modem thing.
Yeah,
and
that is brilliant.
They were, yeah, and they were super reliable. And there was only one time when we had our signal knocked out, and we were up on a roof right alongside the water. You know, in Vancouver has a lot of waterways cutting through it, and we're up on an industrial building's roof shooting a fight or something in the middle of the night, and suddenly we lost control of the puppets, and we're like, oh, what's going on? And then we looked and we saw that an oil tanker was drifting right past us, and like the ship radar knocked us out. Like, I was like, okay, that's not so bad. I, you know, massive, it was like 30 feet away, just, you know, this massive thing just nice. Blasting us. I'm like, okay, that's, I can live with that.
Yeah, I guess if it takes an industrial oil tanker to knock you out.
Yeah.
Can't be that mad.
Yeah. But yeah, it was, I have a few good friends still that I still stay in touch with, and mostly like with Facebook and stuff nowadays. But it's, you know, it's kind of, when you spend a half a year sitting around with people, it's like you do get, especially like people you find like, oh, okay, here's somebody we can like talk about, like how, like what a good Batman movie would be if we, you know, our dream, you know, like if you find somebody you can have that conversation with, then you're like, okay, now we can entertain ourselves all day.
That was right around the time of the worst Batman movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is before any of the serious Batman movies. Yeah. Or yeah,
in the show itself, you will find some advertisements for Batman or Robin
in the background. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, it was a real drought of so, yeah, the superhero. I mean, that's the thing. It's like I guess I'm old enough now that when people are getting really offended by a particular Marvel movie or something like that, I'm kind of like, yeah, but you know what? Like, I can remember when, you know, there wasn't any like Lord of the Rings for like sword and sorcery movies. Like, the best you could get was like Beastmaster, like that, which is a great movie. Like that Beastmaster was great because it knew its corniness, and it rolled in it and had fun with it, right? Like, I can remember when, well, I mean, before Star Wars, I remember when sci-fi was just, you know, all cheap and lame, and you know, there were a few standouts where I was like, wow, you know, that was kind of cool. That, but you know, I mean, did you guys ever see Damnation Alley?
I've never even heard of it.
It's kind of an awesome, I mean, but it's from like 76, so like when you if you saw it now, you'd be like, that's so dated looking, but to think that it's pretty much right before Star Wars,
you know, ruined everything for everyone.
Yeah, but Damnation Alley is a post-nuclear thing, and these guys have to, they're trying to get to a place that's safe, and they have some kind of an awesome armored vehicle that was an actual physical thing that was built. And for years, you could see it here in Hollywood at the car customization place parked alongside it. And it was always like, oh, the damnation alley vehicle. Look, check it out. There's giant scorpions in it. And it's like Jan Michael Vincent or somebody like that. And it's like, but it's super weird and cheap and dated. And it's because, like, before Star Wars, you know, the rule that executives had was sci-fi isn't, you know, it's for kids. It's not going to be a big, huge blockbuster. So don't give them a big budget.
Yeah, you know? Can have the merchandise rights. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, what Star Wars was 9 million or something.
Something like
you
that.
You know, like 9 million nowadays is like a movie with an independent film with two characters sitting in a room talking to each other, you know, like 9 million is nothing, you know, and superheroes were the same way for the longest time. It's superheroes were going to be kid movies
or shows.
and now they have the biggest budgets because they can pull in an audience. So, you know, I never would have thought I'd live to see the day that there'd be like all the Marvel characters having their own movies.
It's such
and
an awesome time.
You know, yeah, it's, you know, so I'm, you know, like when people got mad about Warcraft or, you know, something like that, I'm like, you know what? I remember when all these movies were 10,000 times worse than this. So I can't really get mad about it. I just go, yeah, it's not the first Lord of the Rings movies, but I can't be offended by them or anything. So, but you know, that's just my opinion. Yeah.
Right on.
You're not wrong.
I think Sky got a few questions from fans of ours on Twitter.
Oh, cool.
I put out the call on Twitter and I got some questions. Our buddy Alan Sells wanted to know, what was the most tricky piece about working with the animatronics?
I wonder if you meant building or in like when we were working with the puppeteering.
You're answering, so you get to decide.
I mean, the trickiest thing for, I guess I'll answer them both. The trickiest thing when we were building would be just figuring out how to fit it all into the small amount of space. Because if you compare our heads to the movie Ninja Turtle heads, like they were much more cartoony and bloated. You know, we had fairly lean, muscly looking Ninja Turtles compared to the movie ones, right?
Yeah.
The first movie, a lot of the mechanics, as I understand it, were in the shells, and then they moved them into the head for two or three.
Yeah, that's right. And I know one of them, they decided that the idea was that if you can make the mouth move really quickly, it'll look more natural than kind of slow motion. So I think it's three. And if you look at the mouths, they're just always like super fast the way they move. They're just like, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's almost too much though. And, but you know, you're always trying. I mean, even when practical effects is done nowadays, it's still a completely different world than it was in those days, because the hardest job used to be, where do you put the puppeteers and how can you connect people? How can you puppeteer these things? Because you couldn't just have a guy in a green suit stand next to it with a green stick and just remove them later. You know, you had to, the puppeteers would have to be under, the set would have to be built up off the floor, and the puppeteers would have to be reaching up through the floor, or everything would have to be fed through a tiny little cable with multiple, cable actuator, like push pull, like a bike, you know, a bike brake kind of thing, but tiny ones, or it would have to be wireless. One of the things I worked on for Rick Lazzarini was the last Budweiser Frogs commercial,
which is fun,
going way back. Every one of those frogs had three puppeteers.
Really?
And one guy was holding his breath underwater, moving the frog's body position. And they had big loud speakers that could blast underwater, and they could hear the director say action and stuff. It would be like all muffled. And then I was standing nearby with a little floating platform, and I was controlling the mouth opening and closing, and the throat inflating and deflating, and the little so we could get that. And then somebody was standing on the shore, and this is for each one of the frogs, doing the eye motion and blinks and stuff with radio control. But so it was three people for one little frog, and some of the people had to be right there holding their breath and stuff. And, you know, nowadays it would just be a guy in a green suit standing right next to it, making it do whatever it needed to do,
right.
You know? So it, like, computers, I mean, I like that computers exist, because I think, you know, for movie effects, but I do like that combination of practical and computers, and using computers to make practical effects better,
yeah,
rather than completely replace them.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
there's so. Just something more. There's a lot more charm when you have.
That's why Fury Road is so good.
Yeah. Yeah, Fury Road is amazing, you know, and because you know that you're looking at a real car exploding.
Yeah.
And
real acrobats on poles.
Yeah.
Cirque du Soleil on a moving car.
You know, and think about, like, it. I mean, if you can go all the way back to, like, Buster Keaton, and, you know, and, like,
yeah.
You watch Buster Keaton and he, like, falls off a building and you're like, wait, he just actually fell off a building.
I just watched a man die.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally a thing in a Buster Keaton movie where the gag was that he jumps between two buildings that are like three stories tall. Like, you can't even see the ground in the shot. He jumps over and he didn't jump far enough and he hits the side of the other building and falls straight down. Jeez. And that just happened as a mistake.
Right.
It just, like, he just was going to, he just went for it and he didn't make it. And then, like, when he got up and he was all bruised and stuff, he was like, okay, here's what I want to do. Give me another shot where I hit this awning and bounce off it. And he just added shots to the sequence so he could take advantage of this awesome fall that he had, you know, but there's something about, like, when you're watching that, you know, that's a real guy. Like, you can feel it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, even Jackie Chan movies, or, you know, like, you get that feeling like, okay, this is something that they actually did. And there's the showmanship level of seeing somebody actually do something versus, like, there's no amount of, you know, spectacle that you could create with all CG that makes somebody go, wow, I just saw something magical. It's just kind of like, oh, that's cool looking, you know, but you're never like, wow, like, that CG guy that fell off a 500 story building and hit the ground and didn't die, like, that was an amazing stunt. You don't, you know, because you know they could have done 10,000 stories. Ranting off topic.
Yeah, I'm fine. But maybe that's why I didn't like the Michael Bay produced digital movies that much.
Yeah.
Or at all. I did not care for them at all.
But you know what? I have friends from the makeup business and stuff, and one, you know, guys who are good sculptors, and we were having big discussions when those character designs came out, and I was like, we pretty much came to the conclusion that if you look at the face, the problem is that they're mammal faces.
Yes.
They might be green, but they're definitely mammals, and, like, why? You know,
that's the big question. Why do you have to?
Yeah,
I believe I literally said those words.
Yeah. Why are you doing that?
That's why I don't see movies with you anymore.
It was very off-putting.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question, Sky.
Yes.
We kind of already touched on it. It's from James Fletcher, former guest of the show, and he asked, how do they match the Dragon Lord's lift movements to the dialogue? Was somebody actually on the set? But we already answered that.
Yeah, that was me.
Yep.
I came first, and then all the real actors had to, like, what was it? I have the names up in front of me. Gerald Wong was in the suit. Big bulky guy. And then I never met the guy who did the voice, Christopher Gaze, according to the wiki article in front of me. But but apparently, you know, he would get the footage from the set and then he would do the final dialogue in the studio. But it was pretty much me performing it on the set while I puppeteered the mouth. And then because you want to do that, you want to have the person reading the lines being the one who puppeteers the mouth, because you kind of need to, you don't want to have to be chasing a mouth motion.
Right,
you want to move your thumb as you talk, so you can go, bring me the turtle, you know, and, like, hit the act, you know, where you need to move the jaw. And so,
right.
You know, and I just any chance to just get on a set and yell like I'm a supervillain. Like, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it seems wonderful.
yell at a crowd of soldiers, destroy them. You know, just all like, it's just awesome.
That is pretty.
Those are fun days.
He also asked, there was an episode where it was King Wick, where Dragon Lord was walking around holding Wick. And
yeah,
I noticed that he looked a lot like he was possibly puppeting himself. Like, the actor in the Dragon Lord costume looked like he was puppeteering the Wick puppet.
I think, I believe that on wider shots, he would have been just puppeteering it himself.
Oh, really?
And then when you got in close, like in tight behind him would have been Bill and Adam reaching their arms through and doing the you know, reaching through and poor Bill and Adam, like they were, you know, they worked together. They had a company together at the time. And, but there were a lot of days when like the two of them would just, doing Wick would be like basically laying on top of each other and sweating and just they had to be
it's that this, kind of thing that kept me out of puppeteering.
Yeah, it was just, yeah, you have to get kind of, you're gonna get very familiar with each other's odors and yeah, you're gonna spend a lot of time up close and personal with people and puppeteering.
Yeah. I think that is all the questions we've gotten from Twitter, and we've already answered most of my questions as we went through.
Covered everything I was thinking. Yeah. This has been insanely informative.
Yeah. So
cool.
What else have you been in? Like, you mentioned the Budweiser frogs, and I would have never even thought of that. Like, is there any other obscure puppeteering you've done?
Usually I don't do the puppeteering myself. I haven't done a lot of creature mechanic stuff in recent years. When that industry started changing, basically when computers started getting good at doing creatures and not just vehicles sure. and buildings, I kind of was like, oh yeah, I can see where this is going. And I mean, one of the things I did when I got back from the Ninja Turtles thing is because I was on set every day and eating set food, so I didn't have to and living in a apartment provided by the Kyoto Brothers that was beautiful, that they were so nice to give me, like I didn't really spend money for half a year, and I made really good money. So when I got back, I had a lot of money in the bank, and I ended up doing production design on a stop motion short called More that we did in IMAX format. And basically, I had enough money in the bank that I could afford. I think they paid me a little bit of money on More, but I think I made like $50 a month more than my rent or something. So not, you know, I definitely needed some savings to even have the luxury of working on that.
Sure.
But that was Mark Osborne, who went on to do Kung Fu Panda, and he just did The Little Prince in France. That's now on Netflix.
Nice.
There's like so those are both CG things, but this was a stop motion short, and I could send you the link to this, but
I just found it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah. More. Yeah. It got nominated for an Oscar for an animated short, and it was the best short at Sundance, I believe, in 99.
That's awesome.
If I have my year correct. And so we got to go to Sundance and be on in that whole, you know. That was really fun. But yeah, I mean, I didn't set out to specifically be a mechanical guy. That was just kind of something I was good at on the side, but I'm more of a designer and an artist. So, I used the money to be able to do more, production design oriented stuff. And because of doing that stuff, I started doing a lot of production design. I was never into doing large scale production design because I'm not a construction foreman or a moving guy, you know, like that's a lot of that job. So I did a lot of tabletop size stuff. So I did stop motion. And I also did a lot of title sequence stuff, like when they did the remake of Willard with Crispin Glover. There's a title sequence to that. And you could find that one on that The Art of the Title, I think is the name of the site. And it's like title sequences and like that you can watch, and then you can read interviews with people who designed the title sequences and stuff. Cool. It's kind of a cool website. But we got to do one that was like it was built, like I got to build a bunch of stuff that looked like it was old dusty shelves in a basement full of rusty old things and cobwebs and you know, and we would do motion control across them and find the different title cards. Nice. And then and make this kind of real visceral kind of stuff. And it's there's the crew that did that stuff, we had some problems with the way that some of it was shot. Like it, they kind of blew a couple of our cool gags, but but you know, we had a stop motion rat skeleton that a guy actually took a dead rat and took its skeleton out and carefully turned it into an animatable.
Awesome. That's amazing.
And it stunk. It was stinky and oh, it was nasty. And yeah, so I did a lot of that kind of stuff. And then lately I've been doing, I taught myself computer stuff because of course I graduated from college in 90. So the the computers weren't really a part of the learning experience at that time. I mean, I went to Art Center, and so like Zack Snyder was just a little ahead of me and a few other people like that. So it's kind of weird that some of those guys are huge now and,
yeah.
and random. And, so I kind of started teaching myself a lot of the computer stuff as I was getting older and I saw the technology changing, and I did a bunch of, I kind of learned doing 3D animation on modern Marvels, like just here's how to do a steam turbine or, you know, do like those kind of
nice,
you know, little demonstration graphics. I was kind of, I taught myself that way. And lately I've been doing some, a lot of working on the crew that's been doing all the packaging for DVD releases of the Netflix Marvel shows.
Oh, cool.
So like, I think my artwork is on the cover of Daredevil season 2 DVD. The Blu-ray is like a Joe Quesada artwork, so it's kind of like oh, that's cool. That one's Joe Quesada, that one's mine. Like I'll be in that company. That's cool.
Yeah, that's a good list to be on.
That is not bad.
Yeah, and so I've been working on some of those, and then I'm doing a short film of my own. So
oh, rad.
I'm.
Can you tell us anything about it or?
I'll just say it's a comedic Twilight Zone. It'll probably be about 10 minutes long, but I've been building a big, this whole summer I've been building in my spare time, a big high tech holding cell that fits into a corner of a room.
Awesome.
It's not what I'm using it for in the thing, but you can picture it as like your classic, like super villain holding cell where it's like mm-hmm. a plexiglass door on it. And,
right.
And that's another thing. Maybe you guys will have an insight on this. I always wonder, like, because a lot of times you'll see, you can read into like what a society's going through by like what themes keep popping up in artwork.
Sure.
And I'm like, what was it that for a while that every movie had the villain that would get caught on purpose, get locked up in a plexiglass room so they could sneer and go, this is all part of my plan. Like every movie had that, right? Because Loki, the Joker, I can't remember the name in James Bond, the Javier Bardem character.
That's out of my field of knowledge.
Yeah. But you know, like, but they all, like they, every one of those movies had the guy like, that's my plan. I'm going to get caught on purpose. I'm going to sit in a plexiglass room, sneer at you, and then you'll see my plan work. And you know, so basically it looks like that, and I've been building it, and it's got LED lighting in the doorway and all that kind of stuff. So, I don't really want to give away the twist ending or anything.
Yeah, don't do that. You can do that off mic.
Yes. But so basically, I mean, the premise of the movie is a guy gets, a rental in a place we never say where it takes place, but you can imagine it's like Manhattan or San Francisco where the rent's really ridiculously impossibly high. And he gets a rental super cheap, but the catch is there's going to be a guy in this hide this cell in the corner of the room, and you just can't let him out. And it's like, so can you put up with just having a guy sitting there looking at you sad while you're trying to live your life? And so that's, and I've been writing with some people who are like really good people in comedy, and we've been working on stuff for a long time, and we've mild success and got like one show optioned, but it didn't go anywhere. But that's normally, you know, you get something that seemed like they're going to buy your thing in Hollywood, and it's maybe a 5% chance that anything will ever happen out of it. But I get some really great people to be in it. And when it's all done, I'll send you guys a link. You
can watch. Awesome. Yeah. That would be spectacular.
Yeah. Thanks.
No, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to get my ideas out there. Cause I mean, that's the thing. I set out to be a filmmaker, and then I had skills to build things, and I ended up getting into a lot of that stuff and being more on the art end of things, but still trying to still write and get some of my own ideas out there. Yeah.
To be fair, that's basically the same path that the Mythbusters had. So, you know, you're in good company. So.
Yeah. I know those guys are great. I so recognize like the kind of guy those guys are. Like right when that show came out, I'm like, I don't know those guys personally, but like I know guys just like them, you know. And that's, I mean, that was the one of the reasons why I started learning computers, is because I'm like, you know what, I'm not the best of the best of guys doing mechanical stuff. And I was like, when the jobs start getting fewer and fewer, I know who the people who are going to still be working are, and it's not going to be me. So I better, you know, because I didn't grow up. I mean, some of these guys grow up with dads who had machine shops in their garage, and they learned precision. Like one of the guys I worked with on Mimic ended up being like Robot Wars champion the first year, you know, because he could build, really? You know. So yeah, like there's a level of mechanical guys that are just geniuses. I'm just a guy who can kind of like go like, maybe if I put this here and put that there, it'll work. Oh yeah, it works, cool. You know, and I just kind of improvise and
nothing wrong with that,
figure it out as I go. It's just because I get bored if I'm doing something that's not challenging. So
yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much again for coming on our podcast and telling us a little more about the production and stuff. That this has been just wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for posting on that website.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for contacting me. It's nice to. There's a lot of people in the film business who work behind the scenes, and it's nice to have somebody like reach out and say, "Hey, what you did is cool." Like,
yeah, it's super cool.
It's nice because it's like, you know, I mean, for every, when you see those, you know, 500 names at the end of a big epic movie, know that there's probably another 10,000 people who worked on it that aren't listed in the credits, you know, because there's a ton of people that just don't make it to the credits. And it's just like Keeler Brothers were allowed to put up two names of the three of us who went up. So I'm not in the credits of. So if anybody looks up the show and doesn't find my name there, I'm not lying. I actually was there. I have pictures.
Lying, you had a very good, well thought, detailed lie.
Yeah, I'm actually the guy who the movie Catch Me If You Can is based on.
Well, this has just been a very long stalling tactic, and the police are closing in on you.
Well, yeah, and thank you. I mean, it's great. It's great to talk to people, and I love talking to people who are excited about and passionate about all this cool nerdy stuff, because it's fun stuff to talk about, I think. So
it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And we got to talk about Star Wars. So
yeah, like I was a kid who grew up watching Wild Wild West, and so the Wild Wild West movies like did not do it for me. Because they weren't the original show. I mean, I don't know if you guys ever went that far back, because you guys look young, but that's ancient now to you guys. But that show was like James Bond in the Old West with crazy Jules Verne villains, you know.
That does sound pretty awesome.
And like like when I saw that, I was like, oh man, if this would have been given to Sam Raimi or the Coen brothers or something, it could have just been ridiculous, you know, but
then we wouldn't have gotten a giant metal spider.
Yeah. And you wouldn't add like a guy acting cool, you know, as hey, I'm James West. Yeah. And it's just, oh,
we're not going to spare you. We won't rap the rap because Sky and I know it. Yes, we do.
Oh, awesome. That is awesome, even if I don't want to hear it.
All right. Well, Sky?
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic talking to you about all this goofy stuff.
Oh, cool. I'm happy I'm at least making sense with what I'm saying, because it was a long time ago, and I'm like, luckily I was able to pull up the names of everybody in front of me, because I'm horrible with names, and I would have forgotten half the people's names after all these years. Well, thanks.
After the end of that, you put a little chicken squawk and you go, hey, thanks again for Rick for joining us for that awesome interview. He told some great stories. It was really cool of him to be here, and we really appreciate it.
Yes, all of those things. It was very gracious of him to give us his time, especially since his son's birthday was earlier this day. He was able to fit us in, and we got to learn a whole bunch of really neat stuff. Again, thank you very much for joining us on this silly podcast that we do. You can find Rick at rickorner.com, where you can look at all of his neat stuff.
We'll have some of the stuff that he mentioned in the interview linked in the deal.
In the show description.
Yeah, in the deal.
And thank you very much for listening. It was a pleasure having Rick on, and thank you guys for listening to us talk to him. Not sure why I said that so super weirdly.
I don't know. You're going to have to do so much editing to make this sound natural.
You know, I'm going to have to, like, the interview itself, I'm going to edit very little. It's just fucking 4 minutes of an intro
you're
and outro.
So awkward.
Tim not working. thank you guys very much for listening.
You said the same thing like 9 times.
Yeah, I know. I can pick one, though.
Okay, that's fair. You going to put a chicken squawk like they do in the show?
Macaw!
Wild Wild West, Jim West, Desperado, Rough Rider, no you don't want nada, none of this six gun and his brother running this Buffalo Soldier, look it's like I told you, any damsel that's in distress, be out of that dress when she meets Jim West, roughneck go check a law and abide,
watch your step while
you fuck it.
Flex, get a hole in your side, swallow your pride, don't let your lip react, you don't
wanna see my hand where my hip be at, with Artemis from the start of this, running the game, James West, taming the West,
so remember the name, now who you gonna call,
let the GB,
now who you gonna call
GWG,
and if you ever riff with me with one of us, break out
before you get bum rushed at the Wild Wild West.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
That's just gonna be our intro from now on.
Absolutely.
Very little prompting on that.
Yes,
put right in.
You know that part that I always forget.
Yeah. I think we both stumbled over at least one spot.
Whatever. It's probably better that way.
And then, and here's my other pitch to all nerds out there. The movie that I think they're now too old and it's never going to happen, but the pairing that I would have loved to have seen, the two characters that would have been the best to put together would have been Ash Williams and Jack Burton. Team up of Ash Williams from
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead. And Jack Burton from Big Trouble Little China. take those two characters, put them together. Yeah. Let them go to, like, maybe they go to China and they're fighting with Chinese deadites or something. And it's just two guys who are like super cocky, but also don't really have the skills to back up their cockiness, both blundering through an adventure. Like, that would have been
I can't
the
believe
greatest.
This hasn't been a comic book yet.
Yeah, that sounds too good to not have been done.
Yeah, if anybody listening to this makes that as a comic book, just please, like, let me know about it so I can read it, because that would be my dream mashup of nerd characters.
Two of them on the Pork Chop Express.
Yeah.
I feel like IDW owns the rights to both of those properties for comic books.
Yeah.
It feels
so
right.
IDW.
I know you're listening.
Yeah.